Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Many Rules of Film Club. This is Jeff Yance. I'm the program director at The Loft Cinema, and as always, I am extremely excited to be joined by occasional filmmaker Heather Lades.
Hola, Jeff.
And multimedia artist Rusty Boulay Stevenson.
Hello, my fellow Americans.
Yes, well, so Rusty and Heather, we know that we have recently lived through an interesting slash traumatizing slash historic election.
Yes, no doubt.
Yes. So we felt like it was time here at the Mini Rules of Film Club to look at some of the pieces of cinema that have dealt with the presidency. So presidential cinema is what we're going to be looking at today on the Mini Rules of Film Club. So maybe I'll start out with a film that I'm very fond of. Probably one of the, I would say, craziest movies that I've ever seen.
It ranks up there.
I struggle to find one crazier.
Yeah. And, you know, coming off, I think, an admittedly crazy election, that we can all agree on that, this film really seemed to speak to that moment, but it was made in 1968, which is interesting. It's called Wild in the Streets. Wild in the Streets, directed by Barry Shearer, who is not necessarily a hugely known filmmaker, but he did this film, and this will be his legacy. And for better or for worse.
That's a legacy.
So this film, okay, so I'm just going to try to briefly synopsize this because it's a really crazy concept. This came out in 1968, so it was an election year in reality. Someone named Richard Nixon, whom we're all familiar with. So this movie was intended as a political satire of current political events, as well as a commentary on the counterculture movement, the youth movement that was building up steam in the late 60s. And just kind of to set the historical context, this was a crazy time. It was the Vietnam War. There was overpopulation issues. There were civil rights issues, assassinations, riots,
and
protests.
For the majority of the country, you had to be 21 to vote.
You had to be 21 to vote in the 60s.
But you could be shipped off to war at the age of 18. The average age of somebody who died in Vietnam was 19.
Great. Yes. Yeah. So that's the context which this film was created in. It was a very volatile time. And this film was really attempting to speak to all of it at once, which makes it kind of an insane film. Maybe a little more ambitious than the film itself can handle. But basically the concept of the film is a 24-year-old rock star named Max Frost, of Max Frost and the Troopers, America's favorite pop band, is convinced to help a senator who is based on Kennedy at the time. He's a 30-something senator who is going to get into the Senate on a bill lowering the voting age from 21 to 18, which actually really happened in 1971. But in this film, it had not yet happened. So he decides the best way to do this is to get the youth vote. So I'm going to get a really hot, cool, young rock singer to help promote me. And then it turns out that Max Frost has his own political agenda. And once he helps Fergus, the good liberal senator, get into office, Max Frost decides that he is going to take this opportunity to push his own agenda of lowering the voting age to 14. Which is crazy.
Which is awesome.
Which
crazy.
Is awesome and crazy.
Yeah.
But as he points out in the film, 52% of America is under the age of 25, so the youth control America. And if we could mobilize the youth, we can really make some things happen.
There's still truth in that.
And there's still truth in that. So it's not a totally ludicrous idea. So Max Frost then starts his own campaign. His band becomes his cabinet. Stanley X, who is his drummer, played by Richard Pryor, who is sort of a takeoff on Malcolm X.
Cool role.
A very cool role, yeah. I think one of the first motion picture roles for Richard Pryor, which is kind of interesting. So in order to then get some of their youth folks into the actual White House, they decide to amend the Constitution to allow 14 years old to be the lowest age that you can actually hold public office.
And they're going to fight for it. That's the song. It's 14 or fight.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to fight. Yeah, it's revolution. It's time for revolution. And just to help stack the deck in their favor to get the Senate to vote for this new bill, they dose them all with LSD. So then, of course, the vote happens. And then, of course, the voting age is lowered to 14, as is the age for a public office. So the White House is now filled with teenagers, basically. Max Frost becomes president of the United States as a Republican, I might add.
Yeah.
Running against Richard Nixon, I might add, getting the Republican vote. Gets into the White House, becomes a complete fascist, ends up retiring everyone who's over 30, forcibly retiring them, putting them into what they call paradise camps, which are LSD re-education camps where they're all dosed on acid and they just have to live out their days in these weird concentration camps. And then it kind of gets crazier from there. There's attempted assassinations, there's like more rock music. He ends up demilitarization of the world because he thinks if there's no foreign policy, then there's no wars. We become a police state, of course. And it's basically wild in the streets.
It That's really is.
It gets very wild in the streets. And this isn't even to mention Max Frost's mother, who's played by one of our favorites, Shelley Winters.
Yes.
Who is a raving conservative at the beginning of the film. When her son gets into office, she becomes a flower child, tries to convince everyone she's a teenager so she doesn't get put into a concentration camp. So this movie is kind of a mess, but it's kind of an amazing mess to me. There's so many ideas in this film. It's almost like too much for one film.
Yeah.
But it came out at a time when I think there was really optimistic hope that change could happen, and it needed to be sort of violent and revolutionary and radical. So the idea of having 14-year-olds in the White House is kind of a radical, insane idea, but not totally beyond the pale. I mean, we see that, you know, having politicians who are 70 years old has not necessarily worked out all that well for us.
Yeah. 70 and sober.
70 and sober.
So that's not, doesn't work. So.
Well, and there's a scene in the movie where the senators are like, what do you mean 14? How can somebody who's 14 be responsible enough to vote? And he turns it around on him. He's like, how can somebody who's 60 be responsible enough to vote? And this movie's absolutely insane. But when I heard that, I'm like, yeah, no, right? Somebody who's at the end of their life, these are the people who are voting en masse, and they're making decisions for people who are 14 and who are 15, right? And so there's a real logical argument to be made. I'm not saying that people 14 should be able to vote, but I do understand the sentiment of here are people at the end of their lives making decisions for the future of the world that they're not going to be a part of.
Right. So why aren't the people who are actually at that time being drafted, going to fight in Vietnam, why aren't they being allowed to make decisions that
are going
to affect the country?
Yeah.
So there were some really kind of trenchant political comments being made in the film, but it's also just balls out insane.
The first 15 minutes of that movie were so hard for me to sit through and watch, and it's just, it's all over the place. They're destroying furniture at one point as a kid, and the way they show him aging, it was just really not easy to... I wondered if I was going to make it through the movie. I really did. It got better as it went, and I liked it, but it's one of the craziest films I've ever sat through. It really is. It's hard to imagine it on the big screen.
Yeah, and it was obviously being pitched at the youth market in the 60s, and I think that's why the editing is so kind of crazy. It's a freakout. Like they were trying to make a visual freakout, and the editing is very fast. There's lots of music, lots of jump cutting, and kaleidoscopic color effects. Just visually, it's a very interesting movie, and nominated for an Oscar for editing, which I think is kind of crazy just because it's so extreme.
It's hard to imagine that it was accepted by Oscar voters in any way.
Exactly. Right. So aimed at young people, but suggested for mature audiences only, which I find kind of hilarious. That's how they promoted it.
That's funny.
Because it apparently was too shocking. And then, like, legitimately great acting from Shelley Winters, as always, who's desperate to become the first mother and get in the White House. But her big mistake is she's over 30. Mm. So it's off to the LSD camps for her.
Just the way it goes. Yeah. You decided to age, you're going to the LSD camp.
And it's also very interesting, this film, because obviously it's promoting the power of youth, but it's also a cautionary tale about what would happen if youth took power.
Yes.
Because Max Frost becomes, again, a fascist. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of a great, kind of silly, almost Twilight Zone twist at the end when Max Frost, after he's become the first president under the age of 25, is confronted by a gang of 10-year-olds who tell him, you are really old, and we are going to take over. Everyone over 14 is going to a concentration camp. So where does it end?
Yeah.
Embryos running the country? I don't know. I don't know. So I think maybe at the time you would think there could be nothing more ludicrous than the idea of a pop star as the president of the United States. But clearly we're in a position at this moment in time where that doesn't really seem that crazy.
Nope.
I might prefer it.
Yeah, I might take a pop star of our reality.
Yeah.
Justin Timberlake, yeah. I'm looking at you.
Right.
I might, yeah. I'd go for it.
Right? Song and dance man to go out there and tell us things?
Yeah, yeah. And this character is clearly modeled after Jim Morrison because he's got pretensions of art and ideas about life. And
some messianic qualities.
Yeah, exactly. A messianic figure for sure, which is great in politics, you know, which really gets people
always goes well.
You.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just wanted to mention another film recently that kind of falls in the vein is Idiocracy, which came out 10 years ago. This is the 10th anniversary by Mike Judge, which posits that the president of the United States is a professional wrestler, which 10 years ago, again, seemed kind of ludicrous.
But I've seen Donald Trump in a wrestling ring.
That's right.
And Jesse Ventura had quite a prolific
political career.
In Minnesota,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Linda McMahon is going to be in the cabinet.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. Yes, that's true.
Yeah, so, so we could possibly be actually living in a satire of reality right now without even knowing it. Wild in the Streets seemed like an unthinkable satire, I think. And now it doesn't really seem quite as unthinkable and satirical.
Yeah, some of it. I mean, there's some scenes, the dosing of the water and for the senators of acid, that was really extreme. It really pushed the ideas of satire at the time, for sure.
Yeah. I would like to think we would never have LSD camps, forcible retirement at the age of 30.
Yeah,
but
we would not. Yeah.
But I think that and Idiocracy are examples of the use of extreme satire to try and point out that things are going wrong.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. That we're headed down a dark path. And extreme satire is not for all tastes because I think a lot of people just don't take to it.
Yeah.
The tone is very strange.
Well, they're like not willing to go that far in their creative imagination to entertain that as an extreme possibility.
Right. So, yeah. So I think that's kind of a brave... Weirdly, Wild in the Streets was a very brave attempt to do really, really extreme satire and aim it at kids.
Yeah.
You may not even get that it was a satire, but thank God it's here.
Yeah.
And I'll watch it again.
I guess I'll probably watch it again, too. I really encourage you to try to watch it. It was interesting. I watched it because Jeff said he was going to do this as a topic, and it's really an interesting movie, Wild in the Streets. It's hard to sit through. It's really hard to sit through.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating, but it's got moments of a genius. I mean, it's a really smart film. It doesn't lack for ideas. Like you said, it's got a lot of big ideas in it. So.
Right. But at its heart, it's also an exploitation movie. It was trying to exploit rock and roll and counterculture.
Yeah.
So it's got that agenda going on also with lots of violence and sex. And
two songs from the soundtrack reached the top 25 on Billboard.
Right.
With a fake band.
Oh, don't you love it when fake bands make a real life top 10? That could be a theme.
It's like Archie's and the Milli Vanilli getting into the White House.
Yeah.
And I should also just point out that at the beginning, Max Frost is played by Barry Williams, who played Greg on the Brady Bunch. Just to bring it into a full 70s moment there.
Wrap it in a nice bow.
So that's an extreme example of a presidential film. So Rusty, you maybe have a pick that's maybe not, well, also kind of an extreme satire, really.
It's extreme satire. Mm-hmm. The film I chose is 7 Days in May from 1963. It actually ended up being released in 64. It was supposed to be released in December 1963. It tells the story of a president who, from the very beginning, the opening shots of are of picketers outside the White House who are upset that the president is about to sign a deal with the USSR, with the Soviet Union, to get rid of nuclear weapons. And the citizens and the generals do not trust the Soviet Union to actually follow through on the treaty. And so they think this president is weak. And so the movie is about a general played by Kirk Douglas. He's the central character, I believe. Jiggs is what he goes by. And he begins to recognize that there are several generals, including General Scott, the main general, who's very wildly popular in the United States. He can sell out arenas for people to hear him talk. Jiggs doesn't like the idea either of signing a non-proliferation pact or getting rid of nuclear weapons. But he starts to recognize that there seems to be a plot to get rid of the president of the United States and to replace him with General Scott, played by Burt Lancaster. Mm. Both men play these roles brilliantly. They're really, really great roles. And so Jiggs then, realizing that there's this thing called EcomCon that the president doesn't know about, that he's never heard about himself, is something that is they're going to try to have a military coup to replace the presidency because he's too easygoing on the Soviets and on the threats to the country. And it's really fascinating. It's based on a book by the same title. The screenplay is written by Rod Serling. And the book was really important. John Kennedy really liked the book in real life. He really liked the book. And when they were making the movie, it's directed by John Frankenheimer, I should point out. Hmm. It's the movie that followed the Manchurian Candidate. John Kennedy allowed them to shoot in the White House because he was such a fan of the book. And he really felt like that could really happen in the United States. There was some historical precedence to it. There was an attempt in the 20s by a group to maybe have a coup of the United States of Franklin Roosevelt, and John Kennedy was in the unique position himself of being really unpopular the military probably didn't like John Kennedy that well. Mm. And in fact, he was trying to de-escalate things. It seems John Kennedy was trying to maybe get us out of or off of a war footing that Eisenhower had warned about, the military-industrial complex. And there are people who believe that John Kennedy might have been assassinated because he tried to do that. So this movie really parallels the Kennedy years. And in fact, it was supposed to come out a month after Kennedy was assassinated, but they pushed it back because they just felt it was too soon. And I would be remiss to say I didn't know about this movie before we started to talk or start researching presidential films. It was only after I watched Oliver Stone's Untold History of the United States that I became aware of this film. He mentions it in that. It's a really great 11-part series that you can find on Netflix right now, and it really looks at the history of the presidency. And so I watched all of that to prepare for this, and then he has a lot of references to film and references 7 Days in May because it was so timely. I mean, it came out right as the president was assassinated, essentially. And there are people who believe he might have been assassinated because he was trying to get us off of a military footing. And that's just what happens in this film. It's a really great film. I can't recommend it enough. It's not as great as The Manchurian Candidate. But a great double feature, yes. It would make, for sure. Yeah. And it's really subtle. There are modern audiences who might find it a little too slow, honestly, and a little too nuanced to be bothered to follow. But if you're a fan of old school film and the history of film, it's really an underappreciated little gem.
I think it's very suspenseful.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
It is. You don't know what's going to happen up until the end. It really could go a number of different ways, the ending of the film. And it's interesting, as Oliver Stone pointed out, on December 22nd, 1963, 1 month after the assassination of John Kennedy, Harry Truman wrote an op-ed in one of the largest newspapers. 1 month to the day after John Kennedy died, Harry Truman wrote a letter, an article about how the CIA needs to not have so much power. And it was really interesting that here's this former president, 1 month to the day. You can find the letter. It's a really fascinating piece, the op-ed, and talking about how the CIA is too powerful.
Oh.
And Oliver Stone points that out in The Untold History of the United States, and it's really true. It's right there in black and white. It's hard to believe it's an accident. I think Harry Truman knew what he was doing when he did that.
Right.
I would think so.
So this movie, 7 Days in May, it really talks about, how scary it is in an age of nuclear proliferation, that we're always on the verge, and that there are people who profit from us always being on a war footing.
Right.
And that's what Oliver Stone points out in The Untold History of the United States, is that there's a lot of profit to be made in war, and we realize that in World War II and didn't turn back. We spend more on military in this country than the next 7 nations combined.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so we really have, and it's interesting. It's an interesting movie to watch, and I recommend it. I love it as a double feature. I think it'd be a great double feature with The Manchurian Candidate.
I'd go with the triple feature of those two plus Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
because
oh,
I feel
nice.
Like Dr. Strangelove takes a lot of the ideas in 7 Days in May to like a ludicrous
right.
extreme. Like that's an extreme satire.
That would be a great triple feature.
Yeah, absolutely
it would be.
Yeah.
Absolutely it would be.
And that's one thing that the Cold War, that's one of the great legacies of the Cold War, is all these great films, these kind of paranoia films about the Cold War, which I think still hold up today. A lot of them are still very relevant.
Yeah. One out of trying times comes good art, sadly.
Yes.
Good
exactly.
and great and sadly enough.
Right.
Yeah. No, that's really true. I would like to, if you give me just a second here, I've got a quote that is towards the end of the movie that is just a little too good. Here we go. President Lyman is talking at the end. The threat to his presidency has now been, he's aware of it and he's tried to take moves to stop it from happening. It still could happen at this point, I believe. I think there's still some tension there with General Scott. But President Lyman says, there's been abroad in this land in recent months a whisper that we have somehow lost our greatness, that we do not have the strength to win without war the struggles for liberty throughout the world. This is slander, because our country is strong, strong enough to be a peacemaker. It is proud, proud enough to be patient. The whisperers and the detractors, the violent men, are wrong. We will remain strong and proud, peaceful and patient, and we will see a day when on this earth all men will walk out of the long tunnels of tyranny into the bright sunshine of freedom. And it's a really profound speech at the end.
Yes.
That's beautiful.
That's beautiful. And I think that's a real testament to Rod Serling, who I think was a great writer.
Yes,
I mean,
he was.
Maybe kind of undervalued because of The Twilight Zone. Even though The Twilight Zone is a very well-written show.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's a great
show. It's amazing. And that's one thing I was going to point out, too, is just Rod Serling, he considered this work really important in his career. But in season 4 of The Twilight Zone, there's an episode with Dennis Hopper as the star, and he's a would-be fascist. I think the movie's called He's Back, and it's all about fascism and really scapegoating. And if you listen to that, I can't recommend enough finding this episode of The Twilight Zone, because it mirrors some of the rhetoric that we've heard in this last campaign. It's kind of scary how much it mirrors it.
Yeah.
And Rod Serling considered that his most important work that he ever did. And he did some great work, Rod Serling, I would say, Twilight Zone being among it. But that episode with Dennis Hopper is incredible and way worth finding.
Yeah. So Heather, we were talking to you about a film that's maybe more tangentially about a president, but about a presidency.
Right.
Yeah.
I picked The Conspirator from 2010, directed by Robert Redford. I picked an actual president, not a fictional one,
right.
Which was interesting. And I'm kind of a mini historical buff. So if anything like kind of hooks me in and I want to know about that person more, I'll dig. And this movie made me do that. It's about Mary Surratt, who was one of the conspirators of the John Wilkes Booth gang, if you will. And the funny thing is, you know, we were talking earlier, you know, when you're a kid and you learn about the assassination of Lincoln, you don't really know about any other, they don't talk about the other people involved. They talk about John Wilkes Booth. That's it. And they didn't talk about, I didn't know that the vice president was supposed to have been attacked and secretary of state, I think. And the other things, like I didn't know that John Wilkes Booth and the conspirators had planned to kidnap Lincoln and exchange him for rebel soldiers or Confederate soldiers.
Interesting.
I had no idea they had that plan before the assassination. So anyways, this movie led me to do some more research. And so I found about Mary Surratt, who's played by Robin Wright, who I am in awe of. She is one of, I really do think, one of our leading actresses, actors. She can hold her own against anyone. And she plays Mary Surratt, and James McAvoy plays her attorney. There's other, you know, it's notable, a lot of big actors. Kevin Klein plays Secretary of War. Tom Wilkinson is there as James McAvoy's kind of mentor. Danny Houston is the prosecutor. And so all of the eight people, I believe, were tried in a military court. And that in and of itself, you know, is really a violation of someone's civil rights. And at the time, that hadn't been challenged. And because the country in such turmoil from the Civil War, because, you know, it was ending, but it wasn't quite over when Lincoln was assassinated, they decided to try them in a military court, which is quite unfair. And historically, about a year or so later, the Supreme Court agreed that that was unfair. And in times of war, you were still not allowed to be tried by a military court. But so here we are, military court. James McAvoy is her very unskilled lawyer and not very experienced in any way. They kind of make him out to be a good guy. And, you know, historically, he's kind of so-so. But Robin Wright is so good at playing the mother. You know, she's, you know, Mary Surratt was a widower, and she had owned taverns. And the whole thing was, you know, the question was, she was on trial. Did she know about the conspiracy to kill Lincoln? Did she know that the people who were staying in her home were guilty, that they were planning all of these things? How was she involved? Her son was one of the conspirators. He ran off. So when the eight were arrested, her son was still at large. And so the question was she paying for her son's crimes? And that's kind of how the movie presents itself. It's a good movie. If you like historical dramas, I recommend it, especially for the acting. And not exactly the most accurate portrayal, but I think it's solid and well done. It's a typical Robert Redford kind of historical feeling to it. But yeah, so the question is that the movie has you question, is she paying for her son's crimes or is she really guilty? And they really paint her in a nice way. They paint her like maybe she didn't really know what was going on, you know, and in a way she says at one point, well, James McAvoy is trying to get her to tell him, like, what did you know about this assassination plot? She says she felt she was too nice on her son. So maybe she's paying for that, paying for how she raised him. And so they give her this feeling of being a martyr. And the other actors are great. They're, you know, Danny Houston is a great prosecutor. He's a jerk, but you buy it the whole time. And James McAvoy is great. He's just so nice to watch on screen.
Oh, yes. So, I love him.
He's not classically attractive, but he's so pleasant and his acting is great. And he's one of the, I think, a handful of British actors that can hang with an American accent and not break. Yep. So it was great to watch that and great to watch Robin Wright and all of the side characters. The young girl from Gilmore Girls,
Alexis Bledel.
Yes, she plays the lawyer's love interest, but she questions why he wants to defend her because everyone hates him for it. And so, anyways, the trial goes on, and you learn about this, and they never find her son to come. They want her son to come and say, like, "This is me. This is my fault," to take the pressure off his mom. But that never happens. So the aftermath, like the closing part of the Civil War, they really had like a kind of scorched earth mentality of, we're going to get everybody who is involved and we're going to punish them to the maximum point. We are going to execute them. We are not going to make it easy. And there was a point where she got some, you know, one of the judges wanted to, they got her lawyer wrote a writ and he said, you know, you're right. She was unfairly unfairly tried. She should be put in a civil court, you know, not a military court. But Andrew Johnson at the time and the whole, you know, Secretary of War, who was played like Kevin Kline, was great in that role, was just insistent. Like, we need to wrap up this war, basically. Mm. We need to heal the country. And this will heal the country by executing these people.
Right.
Which I find a strange mentality, but I buy it. Because that country was so full of war at the time and people dying that, to me, that's horrible. But to them, I can see them rationalizing, this will bring our country together.
And we've seen it happen since
right.
then.
Yeah. Well, even still today.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the idea that further punishment of people can bring a country together when those people not necessarily were involved completely, how it was, you know, they don't care. They just want the country to be together. And it was an interesting. Well, and the other more important thing was punish the South so they never rise again, which is one of the lines that Kevin Kline says. And so, anyways, it's a great movie. I'm a Lincoln. Like, I don't put him on a pedestal, but I think he was a very interesting human being, and his presidency was super compelling. So, I loved hearing the little bits and pieces, and through that, I did some more research, and I found out, you know, Mary Surratt really. She knew exactly what she was doing, and she, you know, while they did violate her rights in a judicial way, in a constitutional way, I do feel like in the end, the punishment she got was probably, she was part of the conspiracy. She was not an unwilling victim. She wasn't hiding her head in the sand when her son and his friends were conspiring to kill Lincoln. She knew exactly what was going on, and she was involved with some meetings, and she knew. So, you know, they didn't play that in the movie that way, which I found interesting that Robert Redford chose to present her in a very nice fashion, as opposed to say, let's try to come to terms with the fact that, yeah, she was, you know, judicially and constitutionally, she should have been treated better, but she still was a horrible human being and was a former slave owner and, you know, resented the fact that she had to give up her lifestyle of having slaves and her property because of the Civil War.
Right. I felt like when I watched that film, that made me think this was Redford keeping his eye on the box office a little bit.
Yeah, I could see that.
Because you wanted that character to be somewhat likable.
Yeah,
Yeah.
You wanted to feel sorry for her.
Right.
And it was just so interesting, though, because, that's really not where she was. And so, I mean, I get it, though. I did feel sorry for her in that way. Like, you know, her rights were trampled on to make the country unify under their death.
Right.
But it just really was not her story. And so, anyway.
But this is a good example of why we shouldn't take Hollywood movies as historical fact. Even if they're a historical drama, it's a drama.
Yes.
And you need to go do your research.
Yeah.
And find out the real
story. That is a great point, because so many historical movies that present themselves as historical violate known facts and investigations.
Right.
So I think, honestly, I'm glad I watched it. It intrigued me to learn more. I'll probably even read more about Mary Surratt. And I think for the rest of my life, I'll keep reading about Lincoln. He fascinates me. But I do recommend, if you like the historical fiction, watch it and maybe do some research. Share with your kids that, you know, hey, John Wilkes Booth did not act alone. You know?
There was a conspiracy.
Yeah, there was. Yeah. I mean, so there's been conspiracies. And that's the other thing. The word conspiracy has got a bad name, because conspiracies can be true, but the whole idea of a conspiracy theory has kind of got a negative connotation.
Tinfoil hat is what it means now.
Thank you, X-Files.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and JFK.
And JFK.
And JFK, Oliver Stone.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing. Like, there was this large conspiracy with Lincoln. And so people think, there could be conspiracy theories throughout, you know, and there might have been, but it just kind of takes away the power of it. And,
yeah.
Right.
Have you seen Young Mr. Lincoln?
I have not.
Oh.
Speaking of films that are not historically accurate.
Yes.
My gosh, that movie. I watched it for this, and it shows him as a young lawyer. John Ford film from 1939.
Mm. Henry Fonda.
Yeah, yes, Henry Fonda is Abe Lincoln. He's really good.
Yes, I have seen
He's really good. The movie's nice enough to look at, but I mean, it really is just such a fictionalized account. I don't quite understand the point of it, even, because it wraps itself in patriotism, but it's all just this fake trial that's really an episode of Matlock.
They didn't want to challenge the audience that much back then.
No,
it's definitely not
challenging
to wave the flag, and you know, I could see that. I could buy that. I mean, like, throughout history, they didn't acknowledge the whole conspiracy and everything was that went on to plan that, you know.
Yeah.
Fascinating, like, and just imagine your government trying to gather itself back up and function after the president has been shot and having no way to communicate with each other in a fast way. And, you know, people were still surrendering in the South, so the war wasn't quite over. Like, it blows my mind to think of the situation that they were in.
Because even with the JFK assassination, we had television and radio at that point, so the word got out fairly quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, in kind of a joking fashion, but I do feel like it was kind of worthy. Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. I really loved that movie.
There's a presidential film you don't think about much.
I almost picked that movie, but I loved it because they have great subtext and like talking about where he came from and kind of like taking actual facts and blending it in with the vampire story was great.
There's also an FDR movie that's like that, right? FDR battles the werewolf for...
Oh, yes, yes. Uh-huh.
Some sort of monster. Yeah.
Some sort of monster. It's really bad. Yeah. It's really bad film. Yeah. Like, it's hideous, hideous.
Yeah. I mean, Vampire Hunter's not great, but it's fun to watch.
I love Bob Roberts that's tangentially mentions the presidency. He's a Senate candidate.
Yes.
And you think he'll probably go on to be president.
Right.
I love that Tim Robbins piece about a folk singing conservative who runs for Senate and pretends to be paralyzed. It's really interesting stuff.
I didn't know that.
Just pretends. Yeah.
Pretends.
Yeah. It's really an interesting one. So that's a good one, too, for politics. Yeah.
I did notice, though, because I really looked for a good female president movie. There's one in the 60s that was about a female president, and it had Peter Fonda. I think it's Peter Fonda. Maybe not. No, not him. Can't remember the actor, but who plays the first husband, like the very first husband in the White House.
Wow.
And it's very cheesy, romantic comedy. It has nothing to do with her being a powerful woman and being smart enough to get there. And da, 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 da. It's just like romantic comedy. And they have him, like, when he sees the wall of first ladies, he's putting himself, he visualizes himself in the portrait, and he has like a female, like a very girly hat on, and he's very emasculated by that role. So I have yet to see anything that was, there was the one politicians, the contender with, cannot remember her name, but that was a really good, solid female political movie.
And I think we have to look to television, because television has had a lot
it's
of female
great.
Presidents.
Yeah.
Sure.
Including Veep, which I love.
Right.
Yeah.
Veep and a bunch of TV series. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, movies need to step it up with that.
Step it up, movies.
So here's the Smithsonian says, the first woman president to be portrayed in a talking film dates back to 1953 when actress Ernestine Barrier took to the big screen to play Madam President in the science fiction flick Project Moonbase.
I did hear about that.
Written by Robert Heinlein.
So.
Oh.
Interesting.
We should watch that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I couldn't find it. I think I looked for that, and I couldn't find it anywhere.
Let's I think we've delved very deeply into the idea of presidential cinema.
Yeah.
There's obviously a lot more out there. And I think during this new reign that we're under, we're going to be seeing a lot of films about the presidency and satires.
Oh, yeah.
So I think this could be a good time for films.
Absolutely. And there are some good documentaries out there, too. War Room about the Clintons run. Mm-hmm. For the presidency features a maniacal George Stephanopoulos who kind of threatens some lady in it at one point.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting. So there's some good documentaries. I anticipate there will be more.
I think so, too. So thank you, Rusty and Heather, for doing your patriotic duty here today at the Mini Rules of Film Club. So please check us out in many formats on iTunes, Stitcher, on KXCI.org. Check out our website, themanyrulesoffilmclub.com. And I'm just going to leave us with rule number 805 of the Many Rules of Film Club. Animation is not just for kids, because grown-ups like it too. And we're going to be looking at Pixar films next time on the Many Rules of Film Club, so don't miss that. And thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.